Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Women visual artists have always endured a great deal of bias, from past artists having their unsigned works being attributed to men, to their signed works being accused of being painted by a man, to being shut out of showing their artwork in salons, galleries, or museums. Today, it's a more subtle bias in how art is valued by auction houses, galleries, or collectors, or museums being reluctant to collect or feature female artists. Thankfully, that seems to be changing somewhat, but the jury's still out. My guest today will talk about 15 women who made art and made history, which is the subtitle of her 2017 book, Broad Strokes. She'll be speaking tonight at Philbrook Museum in a sold-out program, which will also feature an unveiling of several new acquisitions by the museum by female artists, which will accompany her program. Bridget Quinn is a writer and art history scholar who's worked at the Metropolitan Museum of Art and taught at several universities. She's an active member of the San Francisco Writers Grotto and is the author of Broad Strokes and a forthcoming book on women's suffrage titled She Votes. Bridget Quinn is my guest today. Bridget Quinn, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
Your book, Broad Strokes, is an exploration of some influential and consequential female artists beyond the few artists who are readily identifiable by name, the O'Keeffes, the Cassatts, Morisot, Frankenthaler, Joan Mitchell.
But, and even those, maybe not to the general public.
Yeah, maybe O'Keeffe.
Yeah, beyond exactly. O'Keeffe. Maybe Mary Cassatt, yeah.
Yeah, but it's also a sort of your own personal story of your first encounter with a lot of these artists you profile. What inspired this book?
This book is one of those things where I can find notes I wrote when I was an undergraduate about this book. It's kind of lived with me for about 30 years. I never thought anyone would want it, believe it or not. I had an idea the first time I read Vasari, who's the great Renaissance artist who became the first biographer of art, kind of the first art historian, when I read that as an undergraduate and thought, there should be a Vasari for women artists. And there wasn't. And it was kind of incredible, decade after decade, not seeing something, really highlighting women artists in a way that wasn't in a super specialized field, but just as a general book.
One of the things I love about this book is, you know, you grew up in the West.
Yeah.
Where you said the hometown museum was
Charlie Russell.
So it must have been Great Falls,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, Great Falls, Montana, yeah.
So Charlie Russell was the artist you grew up with, but you come back east to study art and art history.
Yeah.
So a lot of the stories you tell are these beautiful discovery stories of a whole new world of art that I guess you weren't aware of.
Well,
or were aware of, but not only in a superficial way, maybe?
Right. I mean, it's two parts, right? One is that because I came from the West and came from, in a way, I mean, not in a way, a marginalized art community, which for so long, and I would say until the last 10 years, American art was really New York, and that was it. And it's just now beginning to look outside of this really narrow, what is actually really provincial look at art and the history of art in the United States. So I came from the West and had this picture of things that were important. I mean, the town I grew up in reveres Charlie Russell. The local high school is named after him.
There's a bit of reveration here in Tulsa, too.
Yeah, exactly.
Of the Gilcrease. Yeah.
Exactly. And so, you know, when I came to New York and people would say to me, how did you find out about art coming from Montana? And I would think, well, I grew up with people who esteemed art. It's just not the art you esteem. So there was already that. It's maybe worth saying that I'm one of nine kids and I have six brothers. So I also grew up with a sense, and in the West with this really male mythos, that I was looking for, I mean, it sounds kind of sad to say it this way, but role models. And when, as an undergraduate, I discovered these women artists, it was like a light bulb went off. Here are these important, amazing women of the past who I knew nothing about, who had great careers during their lifetimes. And I was just passionately fired up to find out about them. And that became really one of my sort of private obsessions of my adult life from the time I first became an adult.
One of your first stories is about Adelaide Labille-Guyard, for example. And it's talking about how you would go in front of that picture day after day after day.
Yeah.
And what do you learn about a picture from that repeated viewing, you know, intense viewing for a long extended time? What do you learn about the picture?
So that's really interesting because that painting is in the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and I went to grad school basically across the street. And because I came from Montana and I was an undergraduate at UC Santa Barbara, I mean, this is no excuse, but a little bit, most of my experience of art history, quote unquote, was through slides. I hadn't really encountered, quote unquote, great work in person until I lived in New York. And so to be given a research topic of an artist who there was almost nothing written about in English and then go to the Met and see this monumental self-portrait and stand in front of it every day for years, I mean, so much unfolded, not just seeing these details that you would never see in a reproduction, for example.
Even the finest reproduction.
Even the most, and especially now we have digital reproductions where you can zoom in, but remember, I mean, you and I are probably around the same age. Most reproductions were black and white even. Like, they weren't great. So, for example, to see this, you know, this 18th century French woman in this blue silk gown with a plunging neckline. I mean, it was so, what's happening? Why is she painting? And to really look closely and see how much is going on in what's really seems like a static portrait. For example, you can see her teeth in person. And people didn't show their teeth in 18th century paintings. But what does it mean when you show your teeth? You know, there's a little bit of anger in that painting and a little bit of insouciance. Being dressed so fabulously is almost a way of saying, I'm this fabulous. She has these two female students who stand behind her, and to be there in person and realize how gentle she is with them, how she treats them with real modesty and care while putting herself out there. Hidden in the shadows is a Vestal Virgin, the statue of Vestal Virgin. So these virtuous women from antiquity, also a bust of her father. I mean, it's truly incredible when you encounter work in person, how moving and electric it can be, even from the past.
I was really struck by the composition where she's at the easel looking out at the audience, but really at a mirror to make this image. And the composition of the two students behind her, it's almost like a cocoon of these three women together.
It's a circle of women.
Yeah.
And it's a circle of women in a way that in, say, Renaissance painting, you might have the Holy Family or something very religious, you know, this kind of pyramidal shape. And they're kind of, the students are sort of hunching over her with their arms around her. I mean, it's, believe me, this painting showed at the Salon where for a woman to put her work out in public was to put her reputation out in public. And she was dragged through the mud. I mean, she was accused of sleeping with her sitters. Obviously, that's herself in the painting, but it was accused that her teacher had actually done the painting for her, et cetera, et cetera, et
And
cetera.
These were very common.
Very common.
For women artists, say, of 100 years ago or more, or maybe even not even to
do
this century.
I heard and read art historians of my time make that claim for the past. For example, Artemisia Gentileschi, who's the first painter in the book from the Baroque, she was raped, it's a famous story, by one of her teachers. And it's an absolutely, you know, gutting read to read the transcripts from the trial where she had to be tortured to prove her veracity. And she would be described in later art historical texts, and I mean later, like the 80s, as a loose woman, as lascivious, as having a reputation, like a reputation because she was raped. This is recent history.
Well, and of course, the work you pick for her is Judith severing the head of Holofernes, and this is an amazing, amazing picture. It is
so shocking.
Yeah, I mean, it is, and it's. I think other artists have depicted her holding the head up.
Yeah,
Judith.
There is a Caravaggio where she's mid sever.
Yeah, but this is mid sever.
Yeah,
and
it's much bloodier than Caravaggio.
And when you know this backstory, it's like all of a sudden it has this incredible, you know, there's this incredible story attached to it.
Right, like strong woman getting retribution.
Yes.
And Holofernes was supposed to have been her. He tried to rape her, Judith
in
rape her. She creates a seduction in order to kill him.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that painting has been depicted as a revenge painting, and I think it's certainly possible. She has other paintings that are similarly accusatory of men. I mean, it really comes from the perspective of a woman. She has a very famous painting, Susanna and the Elders, where Susanna is nude and being, you know, gaped at, overseen at her bath by two elders. It's a scene from the Old Testament. And in most previous works, it's very titillating for the viewer. But in this case, you really have the woman's point of view where she's horrified and being assaulted by their eyes.
It's creepy.
It's super creepy, yeah. And in the Bible, they are the villains. And in the painting, they are the villains.
Right.
In her
painting. But I've seen other versions by other artists where it's like, oh.
Well, it's an excuse for nudity. I mean, there's not a lot of excuses for nudity in Renaissance and medieval art, right? There's like Eve, some very unfortunate saints.
Or maybe Greek mythology or
something
like
that. Right,
or
Greek mythology. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. What was the determining factors in choosing the 15 women you chose to write about?
Because, I mean, that's the sad part, right? 15 out of however many hundreds of years of, I mean, really important to say this is a Western history. Mm-hmm. Well, it started because when I was an undergraduate in the mid-1980s, I, like most art history students, had a giant textbook called Janssen's History of Art. I'm sure, did you have it? You're laughing.
Yeah.
and it's just called Janssen, and actually it was called The History of Art. And I think it was 1986, I had the brand new edition that for the very first time ever had women artists in it.
For the first time.
First time. And right. Janssen had said that he didn't believe there were any women artists adequate to his over 800-page history of art. But he capitulated, and when I realized that there were women artists and began paging through it, I found 16 artists in the book, in over 800 pages from Australopithecus to, Andy Warhol.
Right.
At age 19, I found that discouraging, but I made this list and began looking for these artists. So in a way, it was just a framing device, a way to pick some representative artists. So I picked the 15 I did. I said 16. There's a little twist in the book at the end. But I picked artists that I thought would represent different eras of art history, but also that had some big effect on my life, some place where my own biography and my own development as a woman and as a creative person intersected with theirs.
Again, this is the story of telling both your story a little bit as well as the story of these artists.
Right.
And all of them have very interesting stories about them. A couple of very common themes that show up from time to time. Judith Leister is one, which is a Dutch painter, and Marie-Denise Villiers. The reason we know them and the reason their pieces are in museums is because at one point they thought they were done by men.
Right. So Judith Leister was believed, her work was subsumed into the oeuvre of Frans Hals, a great Golden Age Dutch painter. And Marie-Denise Villiers, the painting that is in my book, we have almost no works from her, but what's considered, I guess, her masterpiece, which is a problematic word, obviously, for a lot of reasons, but was given to the Met and was promoted at the Met for decades by Jacques-Louis David, who was probably the greatest neoclassical painter of France. Neither is by the quote-unquote master. And one of the contentions of the book is the idea that work, the idea of connoisseurship is that work is itself valuable. So the hand of Frans Hals creates this masterpiece that is a masterpiece regardless. But what happens is that once it's realized it's not by Frans Hals, it's by, say, Judith Leister, it plummets in value and very often in its critical reception.
Yeah.
So
all of a sudden the flaws are talked about, or the perceived flaws are talked about.
Right, exactly. Suddenly it's not a great painting. Suddenly, actually, I always thought it was kind of a sucky painting, which in the case of Marie-Denise Villiers, this painting that was one of the most popular works at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which if you've ever been there has, you know, tens of thousands of works, for decades was one of its most popular paintings, was suddenly talked about by critics as, oh, I never thought it was that good. It betrays many flaws that add up to feminine wiles or the feminine gesture, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Actually, I think that that painting gets more interesting knowing it's by a woman because of, yeah, of the backdrop.
The subject matter.
Yeah,
matter.
You know, it is a woman. And first of all, it doesn't look like neoclassics, what I think of neoclassical work.
Well, it's pretty late.
Yeah.
It's 1801.
Yeah, but it still looks like you could have, looks like illustration from the early 1900s.
Right. Well,
in a way.
I totally am what you're talking about. What's his name? Maxfield Parrish.
Yeah, Maxfield Parrish. Yes. Yeah. It has a, very much that look. Mm-hmm. And yet it is a striking portrait, and certainly striking for, you know, the early 19th century. And in the backdrop, there's these two figures way off in the distance through a broken window. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that story has just got intrigued me. I assume it intrigued you as well.
Yeah, I mean, that painting. So worth saying that I would go visit that Adelaide Lebiguiar painting almost every day for years. And the portrait of a young woman drawing by Marie-Denise Vierre was on the kitty corner wall. So mm-hmm. I would also look at that almost every day. And what makes that painting so haunting in person and actually in reproduction is a little like the Mona Lisa, which is that there's something very enigmatic and intense in her expression that you want to try to decode, but there's not enough information to decode it. And especially when there's this broken window and this couple, you can just barely make out, but like, what's happening?
Yeah.
And I talk about that tonight.
All right.
Yeah, at great length.
My guest today is Bridget Gwynn. She's a writer and art history scholar. She's the author of Broad Strokes, 15 Women Who Made Art and Made History in That Order. And she's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. She'll be a guest of Philbrook Museum this evening, talking about these works. And there will be an unveiling of some new work by women artists at the museum. Some of these artists were known to me, and some will be known to Tulsa artists, like Rosa Bonheur, mm-hmm. Which has this great, incredible story, 21st century story in so many ways.
Completely.
But she's known because she did a lot of Western subjects. So our fascination with Western art, you know,
are they Western subjects?
Well,
because they're horses.
Well, they're horses.
Think of them as Western.
But she's done buffalo. She's done other things.
It's true. Well, she was obsessed with America.
Yeah, she was.
Yeah. You know, I actually was a high school teacher for many years, and it used to crack me up that my students would always say it was so advanced for that time. And we have this idea of time moving in, or of human culture, especially Western culture, of moving in this evolution toward greater liberty or something. And that's not always the case, not at all, especially for women. For example, that Marie-Denise Vierre painting came at the tail end of when women artists in France were allowed to show work. And there's several decades gap between her and Rosa Bonheur because kind of the clamps come down on women and they're pushed out of art schools and out of being allowed to show publicly.
Backlash. Yeah.
Backlash, exactly. Exactly, in the 80s in the United States. So Rosa Bonheur, like many, many artists, women artists, was raised by a father who was an artist. And he was part of this, I mean, I think I can call it a cult, a pretty wacky cult, a cult of Saint Simonianism. And they believed in the equality of the sexes. He believed in it philosophically. His wife literally died from overwork. But okay, whatever. He raised Rosa to believe she could be a great artist. He encouraged her. He taught her. He sent her to the Louvre every day once they moved to Paris to draw. And so she grew up feeling like she could be a great artist. And that is partly her personality, partly whatever. She felt she could do it and was quite soon after becoming a professional showing at the salons, and she showed these massive, massive paintings, you know, history paintings, which are generally about wars or the Bible or Greek mythology. She was showing things like the horse fair, which I don't know how to explain how big it is, but maybe, I don't know. It takes up an entire...
It would take up a wall.
A whole wall of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which is massive. I don't know that they're life size, but they're close to life size, the horses. And, you know, dozens of horses in this painting. So, but the remarkable thing about her personal life is that she fell in love in her late teens with a younger girl, a neighbor girl who was 14. And they ended up spending a life together. They were married by the other girl's father, Nicolas Mika. A spiritual wedding, I guess you'd call it, he called it. But mm-hmm. it was understood that they were life partners. And they lived their life together as in a partnership, in a lesbian relationship, until her death. Natalie, I'm sorry, I said Nicola. Natalie Mika. And then after that, a young woman painter from San Francisco came to visit Rosa Bonheur and to interview her and to do a portrait of her, and they fell in love and also, quote unquote, married. And they're all buried together in Père Lachaise.
Mm-hmm. And interesting, she had some transgender roles that she played where she would dress as a man at a time when that, you know, that
was
strictly,
illegal.
It was illegal.
Yeah.
And she actually got permission.
Yeah.
She had a pass.
She had a pass. She was able to, she wore pants in public, which was against the law, but she had a dispensation from the police and she had to have it re-upped, I think, every few months. And she would have to carry it around with her to prove that she was allowed to wear pants. The reason was for her work. The reason she gave was that so that she could work in slaughterhouses and be able to work in these difficult situations where it would be very difficult to wear a dress. But she also wore pants at home. She was made a Knight of the Legion of Honor, and there was a lot of discussion between her and Natalie about what she would wear to the sort of the grand events. And they decided she would wear a skirt, but a sort of a men's military jacket, it kind of looks like, on top. But otherwise, yeah, she had short hair.
Yeah.
They were kind of the Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas of the 19th century, really.
Yeah. You know, women artists have historically endured a huge amount of bias, as you allude to in the book. And many would say that continues this day, despite the huge number of women artists there are. But today, in a more subtle way, everything from how museum curatorial departments makes decisions on whose work to exhibit or to even enter a museum collection, how auctions pieces are valued or estimated, which affects their value to a great extent. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that today? Where are we?
Well, I wish I had statistics in front of me because they're so shocking. I mean, they're truly stunning. But one that comes to mind is, just as an example, right now we're seeing the biggest explosion in Western history of museums and art historians and critics and public collections and private collections turning the spotlight on women artists. 2020, there's going to be more exhibitions featuring women artists in the United States than any time in the history of the United States. And many, many museums are dedicating whole programs to it. For example, in Baltimore, the Baltimore Museum is going to only show women artists for an entire year. I mean, it's incredible. And that being said, only 17% of collections in the United States have women artists in them, contemporary art collections. 17% when well over 50% of MFA programs graduate women. The auction numbers are insane. I mean, the differences between, for example, a Jackson Pollock, you know, $100 million, something like that, and something by a contemporary
Joan Mitchell.
I mean, it would be 100 times difference. There's really there's a few women at the very, very top. You mentioned Mary Cassatt or Georgia O'Keeffe, and then it just completely drops off in terms of auction values. Galleries are notorious for showing very, very few women as opposed to men, and that's where buyers go. That's where you develop private collections, and that's where actual economic groundswell for an artist's work begins. So from the very beginning, women are at a disadvantage.
What's really interesting to me is how the artistic community is all of a sudden looking back too, mm-hmm. to artists that were amazing and in some way probably are contemporary to these male artists that we revere now. And yet when you look at the same art, you know, by a woman artist completed at the same time, maybe even a year or two earlier.
Correct.
It's like, well, I see where this work came from because it came from this female artist.
Well, I mean, one of the most unbelievable experiences of the last couple of years. So one of the artists that, you know, I have, of course, had a giant list of artists for mm-hmm. Broad Strokes. And one of them who made it to the very, very end was Hilma af Klint, who was a Swedish mystic in the early 20th century, an abstract artist whose work was only seen for the first time publicly in the 1980s. And I just decided not to put her in because I thought, this is too much just my private obsession. And I was truly obsessed with her. And then a year after Broad Strokes came out, the Guggenheim Museum showed her work and ended up extending the exhibition. It is the by a huge margin, the most widely attended show in Guggenheim history. I think 600,000 people saw the Hilma af Klint show. And here was an artist who was painting in abstraction a couple of years before Kandinsky and Malevich, the people we associate with the development of abstraction, and whose work is, you know, fantastic, stunning, and only now beginning to be evaluated and studied. Yeah. And it's 2020, and 1984, I believe, was the first time her work was shown publicly. So believe me, it's out there. I've said to my husband many times, because we were both grad students in the 1980s, and I had been saying since then, we should collect women artists. We didn't have money to collect women artists, but man, I wish we had. That would have been nice.
Yeah. My guest today is Bridget Quinn. She is a writer and art history scholar, the author of Broad Strokes, 15 Women Who Made Art and Made History in That Order. Some of the more recent artists are getting their due in a great way. And that would be, I think of Ruth Asawa for one.
Absolutely.
Who has all of a sudden just exploded.
I know. Amazing.
As well as Kara Walker, who has made this incredibly powerful art in such unusual forms. For example, paper cutting.
Silhouettes, yeah.
And silhouettes, making incredible work.
Sugar.
Yeah, sugar. Out of sugar.
Yeah.
Yes. What is it called? A subtlety or... A marvelous sugar baby.
A marvelous sugar baby,
which
was,
is a giant sphinx.
Yeah, a giant sphinx in a old Domino sugar factory warehouse in Brooklyn. I didn't get to see it, but I mean, it was one of the events of the year when she showed it. Kara Walker is one of those artists where she really was successful right out of grad school. And I do think an example a little bit of how there can be women artists who achieve success, but there's this tiny, like, almost like there can be one at a time, truly. And they're like the exceptional woman. And there was a lot of bad feelings for some African-American artists because they had been working for decades and not been acknowledged. And then here comes this young woman and she's the toast of the town. But it's good to see some of those artists now getting really great shows. There's a show in San Francisco right now called Soul of a Nation, Art in the Era of Black Power. And Betty Saar, who was a critic of Kara Walker's early on, but who did work for, you know, many decades before Walker came along, is now, I think she has a retrospective in Los Angeles right now. And in the Soul of a Nation show, her work really stands out as some of the best in the show.
Yeah. Bridget Quinn, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Bridget Quinn is a writer and art history scholar and the author of the forthcoming book on women's suffrage, She Votes, and the 2017 book Broad Strokes, 15 Women Who Made Art and Made History in That Order. She'll be speaking about that book in a Philbrook Museum program, which is sold out, which will also feature the unveiling of some new acquisitions by the museum by female artists. Details at philbrook.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.